So the title of my address is The Wilson Window Reimagined for the 21st Century. And those of you that are joining me in the church today are at an advantage because you can actually look at the window while I'm talking about it. Unfortunately, those that are listening online or those that are listening to recording don't have that benefit. I know that every time I take a service, I say one aspect of our proud tradition of a free pulpit is that not everyone is going to agree with what you say. And I'm pretty certain that this is definitely the case for this address. So I look forward to chatting with you at coffee afterwards, or perhaps if you really feel strongly about disagreeing with what I say, why not offer to take a service yourselves? We have a very proud tradition of different voices here, and they're always welcome. For the next 20 minutes or so, I want to take you on a thought experiment of what we might replace the Wilson window with if, for example, some disaster were to happen and it was destroyed. But before I look at how I suggest we might change it, we should look at it, and I'm going to give you a quick recap of its history. For historical detail, I've relied mainly on two addresses by Rory Delaney on the window, an article he wrote for Transactions, the Journal of the Unitarian Historical Society in 2022, a paper by Isabella Evangelisti entitled From the Margins to the Mainstream, the Commemorative Stained Glass Windows in the Unitarian Church Dublin, 1863 to 1918, and the address at the dedication of the window by the Reverend Savile Hicks in June 1918. So, as I'm sure many of you know, that the window that we look at today is actually the third Wilson window. The two previous ones were both destroyed by fire, one in 1892 and a second in June 1916. In commissioning this window, the committee responsible for its installation decided to have the work done by Sarah Pursers on Thorglinna, a Dublin-based cooperative studio founded in 1903 for stained glass artists. The committee selected an English stained glass artist and lecturer in the Dublin Metropolitan School of Art, Alfred Ernest Child, for the commission. As Savile Hicks says in his dedication address, its focus was discovery, truth, love, and work, with the central thought of inspiration in the inbreathing of the divine oversoul into the lesser life of man, the indwelling of the Spirit of God in human life, thought, and activity. And he continues, every flash of colour, every symbol is part of that upbuilding of that central thought of inspiration, the whisper from the eternities, the voice that comes from the soundless to the soul, the call of the infinite to the restless heart of men. So if we look at the window now, I'll take you through some of its key features. The theme of the window is very helpfully described on it: discovery, truth, inspiration, love, and work. The central register is composed of figures which typify these: a scientist, a woman in armor, Jesus, a woman with children, and men working in a forge. In the lower register, there are five historical figures who, it is assumed, also display these virtues: Christopher Columbus for discovery, Martin Luther for truth, Jesus for inspiration, Florence Nightingale for love, and William Caxton for work. Then, looking above the central register, there are a number of smaller panels. The next one on your left is one of an astronomer. According to Savile Hicks, this panel unites the ideals of truth and discovery, and in his dedication address, he mentions that it could represent Galileo, Copernicus, or Newton, explaining that they may have helped man to raise his mind to some faint and faltering appreciation of the tremendous drama of creation in which he plays a little part. On the right, the figures harvesting in the field are seen to unite the ideals of work and love, And in the same dedication address, Savile Hicks suggests that this is a symbol at once of the labour of man, the never-failing providence of God, and the promise of ever-renewed growth. At the very top, and perhaps a little difficult to see clearly, there are three small trefoil windows where three figures bear three scrolls upon which are written, "Ye shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free, and upwards and onwards forever." I'm pretty sure we can agree that it's a very beautiful example of an Art Nouveau-inspired window. And we probably all have our own favourite panel. Mine, unsurprisingly, is the scientist. And I particularly love the round bottom flask containing the vivid purple liquid. I'm not sure if Child was aware when he was designing the window, but the synthesis of the purple dye mauvine by William Henry Perkin in 1856 allowed for the colour purple to be made available to the general public. Until this discovery, purple dye had not been effectively synthesised, and the original Tyrian purple dye, which was made from secretions of sea snails, was extremely expensive. In ancient times, this led to the colour being chosen as the imperial colour worn by, for example, rulers of the Byzantine Empire and the Holy Roman Empire. And in later times, it was chosen by Roman Catholic bishops as their colour of choice. Perkin patented his synthetic route to this colour, and purple clothes became all the rage in Victorian Britain and elsewhere. Interestingly, well, at least for me, the discovery of the purple aniline that you see here was actually a happy accident. Perkin was trying to synthesize the antimalarial quinine drug at the time. So we've had a quick look at the window, and now what I would like to do, after we've had a chance to admire its beauty, is to propose some of the things that I would consider we might change if we were ever to replace it. First things first, can I say there are many things that I would not change. I think the overall design is stunning. I love its vibrancy and its sympathetic portrayal of people and the infusion of nature into every panel. And I believe the overarching themes found in the words discovery, truth, inspiration, love, and work are certainly appropriate ones for framing both this window and our lives in general. So what would I change? Well, where do I start? Have a look again at the window. Does anything jump out at you in 21st century Ireland? Aside from its beauty and history and pleasing central message that has been in our sight of view every time we attend here. Perhaps how Eurocentric and paternalistic it is. Perhaps how the vast majority of the people portrayed are male. Perhaps some of you might bristle at the idea of people like Christopher Columbus or Martin Luther being used as exemplars of discovery and truth. For those of you who know the history of the Wilson family, you may be aware of some of their troubling links to the slave trades in the Americas, and perhaps that's what you think of when you contemplate it. So I propose to start there. And again, I rely heavily here on an excellent article by Rory in the spring 2022 edition of Transactions. That's the Journal of the Unitarian Historical Society. And I'd suggest that you ask him for a copy of it if you'd like to learn more. It really is an excellent article. I've also used a lecture from 2022 by a Trinity academic, Kieran O'Neill, called Public History of Slavery in Dublin. When Savile Hicks gave his address for the dedication of the Wilson window, he said it was dedicated to the memory of a good man, to the service of those who worship here, to the glory of Almighty God. He described Thomas Wilson as head of the firm of Wilson and Sons, ship owners of North Wall, Dublin, and referred to him as being USA consul to Dublin, as was his father, Joseph Wilson, before him. In praising Thomas Wilson, he says, "His is one of many high-minded, generous, devoted personalities to which this church owes so much, and who have bequeathed to us a record of good citizenship, upright dealing, honourable life, and sincere faith which makes our history one to be proud of." In Rory's article, he expertly presents research from the Centre for the Study of the Legacies of British Slave Ownership, established by University College London, detailing 9 separate claims for loss of slaves on estates in Trinidad by Wilson, amounting to claims for £23,320 for the loss of 451 slaves. In this article, Rory also asks a very pertinent question. Were the congregation members really unaware that he had owned slaves and that the compensation he had been paid for the loss of his slaves was one of the sources of Wilson's wealth? Or were they just selectively remembering what it suited them to remember? He doesn't resolve this question, but it's definitely an interesting one, particularly when he then goes on to outline a contemporary of Wilson and a fellow member of this church, James Houghton. In the article, he quotes an Irish Times piece on him, saying Houghton was a staunch supporter of Daniel O'Connell. To his urgent instigation were mainly due some of O'Connell's noblest denunciations of slavery. He was a most uncompromising adversary of slavery, and some of his most severe letters were written against that long curse of the United States. To the abolition party in that republic, his name was as well known as in Ireland. Rory then continues in this article saying, James Houghton was a founding member of the Hibernian Anti-Slavery Association, and he was one of Frederick Douglass's hosts when Douglass made his speaking tour in Ireland in 1845. In the publicity for the tour, Houghton's daughter's names and his home in Eccles Street were published as the address for those who wished to send donations towards defraying the tour costs. Houghton was such an active campaigner for so many causes that his detractors labelled him an anti-everythingarian. His lifetime of social activism and campaigning for social justice should surely mark him out as a Unitarian hero, yet his name is without memorial in his church and is virtually unknown within Unitarian circles in Dublin. Definitely some food for thought there. So now for the fun part, for me at least. My fantasy pick, if you like, for a replacement window. So after thinking long and hard about it, I think I would still like to retain the name, the Wilson Memorial Window, even with all that I have found out about the original benefactor, Thomas Wilson. Uncomfortable legacies affect almost every institution and organization, and how we choose to deal with this is a measure of our maturity. Retaining the name would be an excellent opportunity to include a plaque addressing the history that connects it and our church to the slave economy. I'd also like to keep each of the themes and the overall layout. So, digging into those in a little bit more depth. To illustrate discovery, in the central register, I think I'd like to address both gender imbalances and the lack of Irish people portrayed in the existing window, and suggest the scientist Kathleen Lonsdale. Born Kathleen Yardley in January 1903 in Newbridge County, Kildare, Lonsdale was the youngest of 10 children born to Harry Lonsdale and Jessie Cameron. Her father was postmaster at Newbridge Post Office. Unfortunately, the marriage didn't appear to be a happy one, and in 1908, Jessie left him and took the children to Seven Kings in Essex. Academically, Lonsdale was very gifted, and she won a scholarship to Ilford County High School for Girls, but she had to attend classes in physics, chemistry, and maths at the local boys' school because her school didn't offer these subjects. At 16, she attended Bedford College for Women, part of the University of London, and came top in the 1920-22 University of London BSc examination, with the highest marks for 10 years. She was invited by W.H. Bragg, one of her examiners and pioneer of X-ray diffraction, to join his research school at University College London. And it was there in 1924 that she met an engineering student, Thomas Lonsdale. Following their marriage, Thomas encouraged his wife to continue her scientific work, and she joined Leeds University Chemistry Department as a part-time demonstrator. It was here that she made her most significant contribution to chemistry, demonstrating, using X-ray diffraction of crystals of hexamethylbenzene, that the benzene ring was flat. After their marriage, both Lonsdales became Quakers, and Kathleen identified strongly with Quaker insistence on absolute opposition to war. She was sent to Holloway Prison for 1 month in February 1943 for refusing to pay a fine for failing, on conscientious grounds, to register for employment or civil defence duties which would have helped the war effort. As a result of her experiences, she became a lifelong advocate for prison reform. For the lower register in Discovery, perhaps here both to address the notion that Columbus's discovery of America had any noble intentions, and the murky slave-related fortune that helped pay for our church, I thought of replacing him with Frederick Douglass. And indeed, there are historical links between our Unitarian churches in Cork and Dublin and Douglass during his 1845 Irish visit. And this alone is probably worth a topic for an address another day. Moving on to the panels that illustrate truth. Looking at the central register, I really like this image here. It's one of my favourite in the whole window, although I have to admit I always assumed it was Joan of Arc, rather than, as Savile Hicks tells us it portrays, the figure of truth, symbol of intellectual honesty, integrity, inaction, and veracity of speech. She is clad in armour from head to heel, for truth has ever had to fight her way forward through the grim ranks of opposition, persecution, and cruelty. He then adds, her eyes are looking straight at you. They will follow you wherever you move in the building, and they do. Such has been the artist's object, and he has attained it, and at the same time given beautiful expression to the inexorable fact that we cannot escape those all-seeing eyes of truth. From them, there is no hiding, no concealment. With her, there is no compromise. So if I was to replace this figure, although it is strikingly beautiful, I think it would have to be for a speaker of the difficult truth. And quite a few options come to mind here. Greta Thunberg, Malala Yousafzai, John Hume, or even Seamus Mallon, who has graced us here in our Good Friday services. The lower register depicts Martin Luther, and I must admit, I feel ambivalent about his presence. Intellectually, I understand his vast contribution to religious freedom, but I don't feel any connection to him. I think this very much speaks to my relationship with doctrinal arguments. They no longer resonate with me. My truths tend not to come from them, but from more spiritual sources. My personal preference for this panel would be for some words, for example, from John O'Donohue's Annam Cara. Moving on to the theme of love. I always assume the figures in the central register in the theme depicting love were Mary and Jesus and some other random saintly children, which probably says way more than I'd like about the effectiveness of 14 years of Catholic education. But according to Savile Hicks, it is the figure of love, the mother instinct of humanity, clasping the child, the symbol of the future, to her breast. While at her feet, two elder children carry on the same thought in attitude and action, the elder offering a bowl of food to the younger, and the younger intending to share it with a tame robin which perches on her hand. These are very worthy sentiments, and I would simply suggest that we should not assume that these noble characteristics cannot be found throughout humanity, and that the image should be a more inclusive one. For the lower register in the love theme, here I propose a like-for-like swap, if you like. I have no great animosity towards Florence Nightingale, but I feel that Margaret Huxley would be at least as worthy in being commemorated here. Born in 1856, Margaret Huxley arrived in Dublin in 1883 to take up the post of Lady Superintendent at the Eye and Ear Hospital, and within a year she was appointed as matron of Sir Patrick Dunn's Hospital. She then went on to establish Sir Patrick Dunn's School of Nursing, and subsequently became president of the Irish Nurses Association. When she retired from her role in 1902, Her colleagues subscribed money with the intention of making a presentation to her. However, she refused to accept the money for herself, and instead it was used to establish a Margaret Huxley Memorial Medal, which for many years was awarded to the nurse who attained the highest place for conduct in her examinations. She was also a driving force behind efforts of church members to relieve a previous housing crisis. The Margaret Huxley Public Utilities Society constructed 10 family homes on Cork Street, and it was named Huxley Crescent in her memory. The Margaret Huxley Memorial window on the east side of this church was gifted by her friend, the artist Sarah Purser, but I think she should be represented in a new updated Wilson window. Looking at the theme of work, again with the central upper register, I'd leave this one alone, not because I have any particular grawl for the forge depicted, but I'm just not sure I could come up with a justifiable alternative, particularly when I considered what Savile Hicks said was the meaning of this panel. He said it represented the restless impulsion of the divine within the human, and it finds expression in the restless desire for activity, the love of work, the joy of work, and in placing before you a figure at the forge, it seemed that it was typical of the great human constructive gift which seizes the raw material of the earth and wields it to shape and use. It may serve to remind us that all human accomplishments, all wealth, all civilization are built by work. The framing of accomplishment and achievement in such terms leaves me cold. The violence of the image of seizing raw material from the earth for exploitation does not sit easy with me. I don't think of my relationship with work in these terms. For the lower register, here I very much agree again with Rory and his address, A Labour of Love, from August 2021, to mark the 200th issue of the Uskult magazine and the amazing work of its editor, Paul Spain. I'd retain William Caxton. As Rory puts it, Caxton is credited with bringing the printing press to Britain and by extension to Ireland. The printing press was a huge technological advance that allowed for a much faster dissemination of information and knowledge. The right to disseminate information was a key battleground in the Reformation. Access to the written word and the knowledge that flowed from reading was limited to a Latin-speaking elite. The reformers wanted the written word to be far more accessible to a far wider range of readers and for it to be accessible to them in their own language. So, the availability of the printing press was a significant weapon in the battle for people's minds. Although literacy and the cost of printing limited access to publications, the introduction of the printing press was still a huge step in the democratization of knowledge and the development of civilization. So, for those of you that haven't drifted off to sleep yet, you may have noticed that I have skipped over the registers associated with inspiration. So, here again, I'm going to agree with Rory and his 2021 address and propose that the figure of Jesus be kept in the central upper register. For the lower register, I don't believe it's necessary to have a second image of Jesus included. From my past 20 years or so attending this church, I've listened to inspiring, comforting, and challenging words from many of the world's religions and from many who have no specific spiritual beliefs. If anything, this church has taught me that we are all on our own individual paths. We alone have the responsibility and honor to choose who we allow to influence, guide, and support us. We are a spiritual community in which each person is encouraged to think for themselves in a spirit of freedom, reason, and tolerance. So for me, those are the words that should be on this panel. Freedom, reason, tolerance. And in the final minutes of this address, I'd ask you all to take a look at the window again and think about how you feel about it. Does it adequately capture our belief in freedom, reason, and tolerance? What should we keep? what might go? What would you replace some or all of it with? To conclude, although I have a huge fondness for the window as it stands, and I hope it graces our church with its presence for many more years, in preparing this address, I've learned lots about our congregation's history. And I've loved reading the book of Savile Hicks's sermons and essays. And I've spent an enjoyable few hours contemplating my fantasy window picks. Maybe something in what I've said might encourage you to do the same. I think visiting and revisiting our beliefs, our heroes, and our outlook on life is always something worth doing. As Savile Hicks says in his sermon, The Hobgoblin of Consistency, it's apparently considered that to change your idea on religion or politics or social questions is in the nature of perfidy, disloyalty, and disgrace. At what period of our life is it permissible to sit back, make up our mind about the complex and numerous problems of life and death, time and eternity, and to sigh contentedly and say, oh well, that's that, I shall not change my opinion or outlook anymore, henceforth I shall be consistent. I think as Unitarians we can probably agree we don't ever reach that point where we believe we have solved the ultimate questions of life, the universe and everything, and I hope we never do. This window captured a snapshot of what perhaps framed our congregation's outlook and beliefs over 100 years ago. Of course it may not resonate with us as it may have resonated with them. But even if somebody chose to indulge me and allowed me to design a 21st century version of it, I'm sure someone would come along and pen a similar address in 20 years or 200 years, criticizing all my choices. And that's the beauty of Unitarianism. Namaste.